gotta go.
So how was the president received in this complicated moment?
Well, as Biden exited the church, an onlooker shouted, "Do something," and Biden said, "We will." The Bidens also did take time to meet with survivors and family members. Those meetings were private. Some people in the community that we spoke with were grateful that the president came to visit and show solidarity, support. And those that didn't care for the president mostly just stayed away.
Meanwhile, this community is getting ready to do very grim work to hold the funeral services for the victims. What have you observed about that process, Ping?
It's been a big focus here in the community, and a lot of help and a lot of donations have been pouring in. Jimmy Lucas, the director of the Texas Funeral Directors Association, says that they've sent caskets, embalmers, hearses. They're doing anything they can to support the city's two funeral homes, which are just not equipped to handle this many deaths all at the same time. Next to one of those funeral homes, the florist is working nonstop, making wreaths and arrangements. Kelly Baker is owner of the Flower Patch.
Some days are harder than others, especially when you're sitting.
The other day, she sat with a high school classmate who lost a child in the shooting.
Their baby's favorite was sunflowers. As we start making these arrangements, we're just going to make sure and save sunflowers for this baby so that, you know, her family gets just a tiny bit of what she wanted or what she would have wanted for her service.
Services for the victims start today with visitation for 10-year-old Amory Jo Garza. She celebrated her birthday earlier this month, and her family says that she was a happy, creative kid who made honor roll, liked to draw and paint. Over the next 2.5 weeks, the community will put 18 more children and 2 more teachers to rest.
And here's Ping Huang. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are joined now by James White. He serves in the Texas State House of Representatives and is also chairman of the State House Committee on Homeland Security and Public Safety. Mr. White, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Is it the right call to bring the Department of Justice into this investigation?
Absolutely. It is always forward in coming up with ways to make sure these situations do not occur again.
The shooter was 18 years old. He couldn't buy beer or cigarettes. In the state of Texas, though, he could legally purchase an AR-15 style rifle, a second rifle, and several hundred rounds of ammunition. Is that okay with you?
I would say this. Right now, it is constitutional for him to do that. I am not okay with anyone using firearms to endanger Texans. So, we'll look at this, but for more than 100 years, Texans 18 and over have been authorized or permitted to purchase long arms. But, you know, we will look at this because also what I'm finding out is that most of these, when we have most of these mass shootings, especially when they're on campuses, it's actually youth that are under age of 18 that bring these weapons on campus and that are actually maybe students at the campus. So we'll be data driven and we'll look at this and we'll make the right pivots.
After the El Paso mass shooting in 2019, I mean, lawmakers in your state said the same thing. We're going to look at this. We're going to make changes. The legislator talked and talked, and then nothing happened. In fact, last year, the state legislature voted to loosen restrictions on firearms. Has the shooting in Uvalde made you reconsider your support for those changes? Because you did support those bills.
Yes. Well, if I could put some context to that. One of the measures that we did pass was the lie and try. So the idea is that when you're filling out that form in lieu of the federal background check and you purposely lie in order to mislead someone that's doing that background check on the federal end, we did make that a federal offense. A state offense. It was already a federal offense, but we also made it a state offense and we elevated it to the felony range.
That was one out of several different proposals that were put forth to the legislature. You also made it okay to carry a revolver without a permit.
Okay. And that was for that was for Texans 21 and older, okay? In respect to your question, again, after the school shootings in Santa Fe, we did pass several school safety measures in response to that. So anything that we considered last session and we passed last session as it relates to constitutional firearms rights did not specifically apply to the tragic event in Uvalde.
You're the chairman of the House Committee on Public Safety. Should the rights of gun owners in your state outweigh the rights of children to go to school without getting killed by someone using those weapons?
I would say no, because here's the deal. Using weapons in an unlawful way to take a life. Also in Texas, we do not permit guns on school campuses. In fact, within a 300-foot buffer around school campuses, when you commit a crime with that weapon in possession, it's actually enhanced. So we do not lawfully permit, unless you're law enforcement, these weapons on our campuses. And no, I am not okay with people abusing constitutional rights. Certainly. And killing children.
You would not support then a measure to allow or encourage teachers to carry weapons then?
Well, we have that measure in Texas. Those teachers, and it really could be a teacher, it could be administrators, it could be staff that's employed at the school. They go through training. They go through a mental background check. So there are heightened protections and provisions for that. So I do support the discretion of local school boards in those decisions.
Even though the presence of more guns in the Uvalde shooting didn't make a difference.
Well, what do you mean, the presence of more guns in the Uvalde? In what respect?
There were police who were armed, who were inside the building, and still 19 children died.
Okay. Well, this is, to your point there, on the police that were in the building while the children passed away, that's part of the federal investigation to look at why those officers were in the building and they were not given the go-ahead order to take the shooter out. That will be investigated. But what I'm hearing from Texans around the state is that they would like to see more law enforcement on the campuses protecting these students and teachers.
But close to a majority of Texans also say that there should be stricter gun safety laws. We'd love to have you on to talk more about this. James White serves in the Texas House of Representatives and is chairman of the State House Committee on Homeland Security and Public Safety. He joined us on Skype. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, 19 past 8 right now. And coming up after news at the bottom of the hour, the presidential race in Columbia is headed for a runoff election after...
Listed on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C. Their photos are featured in Wisconsin Remembers, A Face for Every Name, an exhibit developed by WPR, PBS Wisconsin, and the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. Access the exhibit online and find out how your community group can host Wisconsin Remembers at wpr.org/veterans. Support for WPR comes from Milwaukee Public Museum, housing natural and cultural exhibitions, including life-size villages, dioramas, a planetarium, and more. Visitor and event info at mpm.edu.
GTD comes from Kenosha Harbor Market, open every Saturday from 9 until 2 on 2nd Avenue, celebrating its 20th season with your favorite fruit, produce, prepared foods, crafts, and other handmade goods vendors. The original Kenosha Harbor Market.
Here's what the weather forecast looks like today. Partly to mostly sunny across the state. Rain and thunderstorms are likely in the north, and some of the storms could be severe, with large hail, high winds, and heavy rain. Highs mostly from the upper 80s to low 90s, but in the 70s and 80s near the lakes.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Noom, providing an online evaluation and the tools to help people lead healthier lives through behavior change. More information at Noom, Noom.com. From Fisher Investments. Fisher Investments is a fiduciary, which means they always put clients' interests first. Fisher Investments, clearly different money management. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Avalara. With tax compliance software for businesses, working to help companies big and small to turn tax complexity into simplicity. More at avalara.com.
From NPR News, I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. There are increasing reports of the Russian army forcibly deporting Ukrainian civilians and holding them captive to help a young woman who is still missing. And a warning, the next several minutes include descriptions of violence.
Victoria Andrusha, 25, was teaching middle school math in Brovary, a suburb of Kyiv. Bombs started falling there almost as soon as the war began. So she came to stay with her parents in the village of Novy Bykiv, thinking it would be safer, but no. On February 27th, the Russian soldiers got to their village. A few weeks later, they came to their home. Based on some pictures and messages on her phone, they accused Andrusha of informing the Ukrainian army about the movements of Russian soldiers, and they took her away. She just came up to me, kissed me, and she asked for warm socks, says her mother, Katerina Andrusha, with tears in her eyes. And then she asked the soldiers' permission to say goodbye to her father. They came back later and took Katerina too. They kept her in the basement of a house nearby, blindfolded, for 3 days. The Russians didn't let me go, they just ran away, says Katerina, because on March 31st, the Ukrainian army reclaimed the village of Novy Bykiv. Victoria was still missing, but as the citizens of the town picked up the pieces of their lives, her family started to hear from people who had seen her in captivity, and what they heard scared them. NPR spoke to five people arrested in the area at different times by Russian soldiers. They were all transported by armored personnel carrier and or helicopter across the Russian border, Ukrainian border. Victoria Andrusha was seen in both places, and those who didn't see her heard rumors about the brave teacher from Brovary. You feel like you're half alive and half dead, says Misha, a 28-year-old taxi driver and video blogger. He says the Russians took him on March. He didn't want his last name used because he fears retaliation. Misha spent the first 2 days in a pit lined with cardboard in freezing weather. Then he was taken to the tents. At the time, there were about 150 to 200 people there, he estimated. All five of our interviewees said the tents were surrounded by barbed wire, guarded by German shepherds, and sniped them for moving too slowly. But all five people said Glushkova was nowhere near as bad as Kursk. 6 hours using boxing gloves. They wanted to show us who was boss, he said. They used stun guns to deliver electric shocks to his legs and back. Once a week, someone would visit the prisoners, introducing himself as a civilian Russian prosecutor. This is the person who in the Russian legal system would be tasked with overseeing the welfare of prisoners. Sergei, another former captive in Kursk, says when they beat him heavily on the first day, their jailers warned them to lie and tell the prosecutor that everything was fine, that they were being treated well. Sergei is 27 and works in Ukraine's Ministry of Infrastructure. He and Misha don't know each other. He, too, asked not to use his last name because he fears retaliation. Serhii says he was arrested outside Kyiv in late February for having a navigation device in his car. Russian soldiers stabbed his hands. He suffered severe frostbite in his feet after being held captive outdoors. When he got to the tent camp, he saw a Russian doctor who amputated. Serhii didn't see Victoria himself, but he heard rumors about the civilian woman prisoner, the math teacher, who insisted on speaking Ukrainian and being patriotic. The people NPR talked to were all eventually exchanged for Russian soldiers. Prisoners were being swapped frequently, says Misha, and before they left, there was what he called a goodbye ceremony. The jailers formed two lines on either side of a corridor, he said. They put sacks on the ground to make it slippery. They forced the prisoners who were being released to run down the corridor singing the Russian national anthem. As they did, they hit them again with the stun guns. Misha thinks he recognizes the guy he was swapped with on April 10th. It was a skinny, dark-haired Russian soldier, the same one maybe that he drove to a checkpoint in his taxi not long before he was first arrested. Meanwhile, Victoria Andrusha's mother is waiting and hoping. Her family is contacting everyone they can think of, trying to arrange an exchange that will get her released. And we're not the only ones waiting for her, her big sister Irina says.
This is NPR News.
Every story of migration is unique, but even in the best of circumstances, migration can take a toll.
Simply relocating doesn't erase whatever fundamental issues or needs or demons or whatever in us.
The emotional challenges of leaving your country, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
This is Morning Edition on WPR. In news, the costs of buying a home in Wisconsin are rising. Coming up in our newscast, we'll hear more about April's housing numbers. That's after this update from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Funeral services begin today for some of those killed in the deadly shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. NPR's Ping Huang says 19 children and two teachers were killed by a gunman who entered the school.
Members of the Texas Funeral Directors Association have sent caskets, embalmers, and hearses from across the state to Uvalde. Jimmy Lucas, the association's director, says they're doing anything they can to help support the city's two funeral homes.
The town of Uvalde, funeral homes are a little smaller, and so certainly just not accustomed to the that amount of loss that fast.
At one funeral home, a visitation is scheduled for 10-year-old Amory Jo Garza, an honor roll student who celebrated her birthday this month. Over the next 2.5 weeks, the community will put 18 more children and two more teachers to rest. Ping Huang, NPR News.
The Justice Department says it's conducting an independent review of law enforcement's response to Lavin's program. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. A Wisconsin World War II veteran died last month, the day after receiving a congressional medal. The Eau Claire Leader-Telegram reports that Raleigh Nays of Chippewa Falls was part of Merrill's Marauders, a unit of several thousand U.S. soldiers who attacked the Japanese from behind their lines in Burma in 1944. The unit was named for its leader, Brigadier General Frank Merrill. Only three of the roughly 3,000 original Marauders remain alive. Congress last fall approved the Congressional Gold Medal for all the soldiers in the unit. Nays received his on April 20th at the assisted living home where he was living. He died in his sleep early the next morning at the age of 99. Home prices have been rising for years in Wisconsin. Rising mortgage rates are pushing the cost of buying a home even higher. According to the latest report from the Wisconsin Realtors Association, the median price of a home in Wisconsin stood at over $265,000 last month. That's up 13% from April 2021. Home sales fell last month, and Marquette University economist David Clark says that's likely to continue into the peak home buying months.
It'll be a solid summer for sales if you look at the last 5 to 7 years, but it'll certainly be weaker than last year and weaker than the year before that. Declining affordability will be the reason for that.
Affordability is being hampered by mortgage rates, which averaged 4.98% last month. A year earlier, they stood at just over 3%. The Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office issued a warning Saturday afternoon about a recent spate of fatal drug overdoses. That's according to the Journal Sentinel. A social media post from the office Saturday afternoon said that 6 probable overdose deaths had been reported within the past 24 hours. The office cited fentanyl in its post. The powerful opioid was linked to at least 489 deaths in the county last year. In 2021, 643 people died of drug overdoses, a nearly 54% increase in just 2 years, according to a prior Journal Sentinel report. In WPR weather today, partly to mostly sunny across the state. Rain and thunderstorms are likely in the north, and some of the storms could be severe, with large hail, high winds, and heavy rain. Highs mostly from the upper 80s to low 90s, but in the 70s and 80s near the lakes. It's WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station, and from USPS, serving every... and from Paycom, a tool for HR and payroll, designed for productivity, allowing employees to perform their HR and payroll tasks in a single software. Learn more at paycom.com/radio.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Rachel Martin, the president and a populist real estate mogul. NPR's John Otis is in Bogota covering the race, and he broke down those differences for us.
Well, they're both quite unorthodox. In first place yesterday was Gustavo Petro with 40% of the vote. He's a former left-wing guerrilla who later served in Congress and as the mayor of Bogota, and he's now on his third run for the presidency. And Petro's promised some pretty big changes here. He wants to phase out the production of oil, which is Colombia's biggest export. He wants to raise taxes on the rich to fund anti-poverty programs. And he's also plans to reestablish diplomatic relations with the authoritarian regime next door in Venezuela. So all of this has Colombia's business leaders and social elites on edge.
He came in first, but he didn't win an outright victory, right? What happened?
In Colombia, unlike the U.S., you need to win more than half the votes to avoid going to a runoff, and that didn't happen. Rodolfo Hernandez was runner-up with 28% of the vote. And he's a really colorful character. He made his fortune in real estate. He went on to become mayor of the northern city of Bucaramanga. And ideologically, he's just all over the map. He's pro-business, but for example, he also supports abortion rights and legalizing marijuana. His main claim to fame as mayor was getting caught on video slapping a city councilman in the face in an argument over corruption. Whoa. He's 77, and he's also prone to gaffes. On one occasion, he praised Adolf Hitler when he meant to say Albert Einstein. He's skipped candidate debates. He's conducted most of his campaign on TikTok videos, and he even granted a TV interview in his pajamas.
Okay. So, so he's a colorful character, but what's the political appeal? What's the appeal of his platform to voters?
Well, Hernandez appeals to Colombians who are sick of political corruption and business as usual. He plays up this image of himself as this kind of gruff and foul-mouthed anti-corruption crusader. Again, Hernandez made millions in real estate, which in Colombia is an area riddled with corruption. His campaign is self-financed, so he claims that if he wins the presidency, he's not going to owe anybody. But he also faces graft accusations from his time as mayor, and that case is set to go to trial in July.
So the next president's either going to be this real estate developer or this former left-wing guerrilla. I mean, these are political outsiders either way, and that's a big deal, right?
Yeah, you know, in Colombia, the winning candidates have always come from centrist or conservative political parties, and neither of the current candidates, not Gustavo Petro, not Rodolfo Hernandez, fits this bill. But Colombians have become really frustrated by political. I really seem ready for something completely different.
John Otis reporting from Bogota. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you very much.
The baby formula shortage has rekindled a debate over the advantages and disadvantages of breastfeeding. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
When an Air Force C-17 landed in Indianapolis last weekend, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack was on hand to welcome 78,000 pounds of infant formula that was rushed in from Switzerland.
I'm told that this shipment provides enough formula to take care of 9,000 babies and 18,000 toddlers for a week.
And Vilsack said that's only the beginning. A second plane load of formula arrived on the East Coast a few days later.
We're going to continue to look for ways in which we can expand supply and expand our capacity. We're going to take a look at the flexibilities, the ability to substitute more easily.
Some observers say this worldwide hunt for formula would not be necessary, though, if the U.S. made more of an investment in a homegrown substitute, breast milk.
If we did more to support breastfeeding, we wouldn't be in this mess.
Melissa Bartik is a doctor and professor at Harvard Medical School. She's been studying and promoting the benefits of breastfeeding since running into hospital roadblocks trying to nurse her own child more than two decades ago.
I had suffered so much feeding my child, I didn't really think that anybody should have to suffer just to feed their child. I thought it would be sort of a maternity leave project, but here I am 23 years later, still working on it.
The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that most babies be fed exclusively with breast milk for the first 6 months. But at last count, only about one in four babies born in the U.S. met that target. There are a variety of reasons families turn to supplemental formula or stop nursing altogether. But Bartik says aggressive marketing by formula makers is partly to blame.
The formula makers would just give tons and tons of free formula to the hospital to try to sell their brand and have the hospital send mothers home with gift bags full of formula. So if they run into any problem at home, they just pop in a ready-to-feed bottle in the baby, and that starts the mother becoming dependent on formula.
Some hospitals now prohibit formula giveaways, but Bartik says the manufacturers find creative workarounds.
Frankly, they have way, way more money than us, and we can't fight that.
Half the formula sold in the U.S. is paid for by the federal government to support low-income families. Babies that receive that subsidized formula are less likely to ever breastfeed than those who don't. Since 2005, global formula sales have more than doubled to $55 billion. Still, this year's shortage has put a harsh new spotlight on the formula industry. The Federal Trade Commission has launched an inquiry into how a handful of companies came to dominate the market. And some are calling for a more reliable way to keep babies fed. 10 mothers stop breastfeeding earlier than they'd like. Russ says there's too little training from healthcare providers, too few pumping options for mothers at work, and too little family leave.
It's a little bit demoralizing when you have a baby and you're talking to your friends like in these other countries and they're going to have a year of leave to nurse their children and you don't. It's not easy to breastfeed. Mothers need support. It's not an easy process. It's work.
Dr. Bartik argues boosting breastfeeding rates would bring substantial health care savings since nursing babies suffer less from ear infections, diarrhea, obesity, and other ailments. But Russ says building the economic case for breastfeeding requires a more inclusive kind of accounting.
If you buy formula, that goes into GDP as a transaction. Breastfeeding isn't. And in fact, what may show up in national economic statistics is that you may be working less. I think that it's important to understand that breast milk is part of food systems. It is a supply chain in itself.
Boosting breastfeeding rates won't solve the immediate formula shortage, but the memory of those empty store shelves may prompt some families to take a second look at formula's original competition. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
And you're listening to Morning Edition on WPR. Here's what's coming up in 9 minutes. Some state legislatures are trying to reform their recycling systems, which are generally inefficient and expensive to run. One particularly consequential battle is taking place in New York State.
I'm Matt.
And I'm Molly. We're from Marshfield, Wisconsin.
The last vehicle we donated was a 2005 Volkswagen Jetta.
The car was wonderful and we have great memories with it. We realized it wasn't going to make it anymore. We knew that WPR was the place that we wanted to donate.
It's a nice way to be able to support WPR. There's no doubt about it.
Find out how you can donate at WPR.org/vehicle.
Support for WPR comes from the Boulder Junction Chamber of Commerce, offering shopping, lodging, and a network of outdoor trails and activities in Boulder Junction, Wisconsin. More information is at boulderjct.org.
Support for WGTD comes from the Racine Theatre Guild. ABBA's music comes alive in Mamma Mia, the musical celebrating family and friendship. On stage at the Racine Theatre Guild, May 20th to June 12th. More information at racinetheatre.org.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, and here's some of what's happening in the news. Families across Africa are paying about 45% more for wheat flour as Russia's war in Ukraine blocks exports from the Black Sea. Some countries like Somalia get more than 90% of their wheat from Russia and Ukraine. The United Nations is warning that the price hikes are coming as many parts of Africa are facing drought and hunger. The UN already had warned that an estimated 13 million people were facing severe hunger in the wider Horn of Africa region as a result of a persistent drought. The first hurricane of the season has formed off Mexico's southern Pacific coast and is rapidly growing stronger ahead of an expected strike along a stretch of tourist beaches and fishing towns as a major storm. The U.S. National Hurricane Center says Hurricane Agatha could hit as a Category 3 hurricane this afternoon or evening in the area near Puerto Escondido and Puerto Angel in the southern state of Oaxaca. We'll have all the latest news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio just after 9 o'clock.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fidelity Wealth Management, working to help investors keep more of what they earn with tax-efficient strategies. At fidelity.com/wealth, investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, member NYSE. From Indeed, a hiring platform for helping businesses of all sizes attract candidates, all from one place. More at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Lemelson Foundation.
It's Morning Edition.
War in Ukraine is disrupting about a third of the global wheat supply. So farmers elsewhere who can bring in a good wheat crop this year will likely get record prices. But for farmers in Montana, one of the top five wheat-producing states in the U.S., a persistent drought and high inflation have brought only pessimism. Yellowstone Public Radio's Olivia Wheats reports.
Nathan Kane pilots his tractor across wheat fields that stretch as far as the sky above. When a little sprinkle of rain blows through, enough to turn on the windshield wipers, his chapped lips curve into a smile.
Just to have raindrops on the window is nice to see. Even though it's not much, it's just nice to see water.
Usually, this whole field would be green by now, with wheat Kane planted in the fall.
Yep, if you grab that.
But this year, there are a lot of brown, dry patches. He hops out of his tractor and digs into the soil.
See if I can find any kernels here.
8 months after planting, the seeds haven't yet come out of the ground.
We've been finding in these droughted out areas of just some wheat that never germinated.
As a dryland farmer, Kane relies entirely on rainfall to water his crops. Planting into dry soil last fall, during the worst drought Montana has seen in decades, he took a chance.
You hear jokes, the biggest gamblers are farmers, because we risk so much. We put so much money in the ground and we have next to no control.
Now he's rolling the dice on planting spring wheat where his previous crop failed. That means burning more diesel in his tractor, though. The price of a gallon has doubled since last fall.
So now it's just going through all of the areas in this field that look pretty weak, or there's no stand at all, or it's just really patchy stand, to put some seeds in the ground and hope they come up. I don't know.
The fertilizer he applied to the failed crop in the fall will still work on what he's planting now. That helps when fertilizer prices are going up faster than diesel. Vince Smith, an economics professor at Montana State University, says that's due to high energy prices and global demand.
We're definitely looking at a fertilizer bill that's between double and a little bit more than double what would have been the case last year.
But the same thing driving up the cost of what Cain needs to grow wheat is also driving wheat prices sky high.
Wheat prices are at record levels right now, upwards of $11 or $12 a bushel.
While conditions on the ground vary from farm to farm, Professor Smith says it won't take a bumper crop for Montana farmers to make a buck.
The much higher prices they can expect to receive for the crops they expect to produce, in fact, more than offset any increase in their variable costs of production.
But that assumes farmers like Nathan Cain, who have no irrigation, will get a break from what's now the second year of Montana's drought.
Our crops can survive and produce okay if we get rains at the right time. But worst case scenario is it stays the way it has been, where we're just not getting anything. We're measuring our rainfalls currently in hundreds.
Farmers in Montana are taking a gamble this year. Cain is hopeful he'll get back more than what he put in. For NPR News, I'm Olivia Wietz in Bozeman, Montana.
Stay tuned for the latest news from NPR and WPR, and then classical music for your Memorial Day with Stephanie Elkins.
Support comes from the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin, performing its rescheduled tribute to composer Glenn Burley Saturday, June 4th at 7 p.m. at First Presbyterian Church in Racine. Information and tickets are available online at choralartsonline.org.
Empire and award-winning singer-songwriter Paco Frelick. Get tickets and learn more at wpr.org/presents.
In sports, the Brewers shut out the Cardinals 8-0 yesterday to split the four-game series. Milwaukee will start four against the Cubs at noon today. And in weather, partly to mostly sunny across the state, rain and thunderstorms are likely in the north, and some of the storms could be severe, with large hail, high winds, and heavy rain. Highs mostly from the upper 80s to low 90s, but in the 70s and 80s near the lakes. On Tuesday, partly sunny with a good chance of rain and storms, and there might be some more severe weather in the north. Highs ranging from the...
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Most Americans have been recycling for about three decades now, but relatively little material actually gets repurposed. Some states argue the manufacturers need to step up. A battle in New York State shows what is at stake. NPR's Matthew Sherman reports.
Plastics are especially tricky. Some types are simply impossible or impractical to recycle.
The plastics industry is fine.
The Environmental Protection Agency says less than 10% of the plastic produced each year is recovered. The rest is burnt or buried, costing taxpayers billions of dollars a year in collection and processing costs.
Very often, companies and big brands use plastics because it's dirt cheap. But it's not cheap for our health, and it's not cheap for the environment.
Enk says that if companies, rather than local governments, were financially responsible for the waste they create, they'd be more conscientious. That's the idea behind something called extended producer responsibility. Beverage companies, food manufacturers, and other producers would keep track of how much hard-to-recycle packaging they use, and then they'd cover the cost of disposing of it. The approach began in Europe in the 1990s and was recently adopted by the Maine, Oregon, and Colorado legislatures. Democrat Todd Kominski has introduced similar legislation in the New York State Senate.
We think corporations will produce less virgin materials because they're charged by the amount they'll put out there, and certainly less eco-unfriendly materials.
To the consumer, the recycling system would pretty much stay the same, but the packaging around consumer products would look different.
Packaging doesn't have to be the way we know it. Why, when you buy a box of cereal, is there packaging with another packaging? You know, you reach into the box and there's a sleeve containing Cheerios or something. But when you get potato chips, it's just in the sleeve.
Some food and beverage companies, and even plastics manufacturers, say they support such a waste reduction strategy. Michael Washburn is a senior policy advisor at the Recycling Partnership, an organization funded by General Mills, Coca-Cola, and other corporations.
Some of them are eager to do it because they want the material back to get into their supply chains.
But there is a catch. Washburn says producers want to be involved in setting fees and targets, and that's the main point of contention as the New York legislative session nears its June 2nd end date.
How could you run a system of this scale and get companies ultimately to change their packaging design, possibly shift to using more sustainable materials? How could we possibly do that without their participation?
Some lawmakers would let manufacturers propose their own reduction targets that would be approved by the state. But others say only the state should set the targets. They want companies to reduce the amount of non-reusable packaging by half in the next 10 years. Judith Enck supports that.
We all grew up learning the sing-songy reduce, reuse, recycle. Well, we never get to reduce and reuse. Now is the time.
New York's bill could also serve as a model for other states to follow, which is why both sides are fighting hard to influence the outcome. Matthew Sherman, NPR News.
In Colorado, a rosebush no one's seen bloom for 80 years has budded. It's a splash of color in an otherwise dim chapter of American history. From Colorado Public Radio, Ryan Warner reports.
This rosebush, really more of a bramble, has clung to life at Camp Amachi, where the U.S. government incarcerated more than 10,000 Japanese Americans in World War II. It's a remote, hardscrabble place, and today mostly foundations remain. But in 2012, an archaeological expedition turned up a sign of life.
How can we be traipsing around in this godforsaken area, and then all of a sudden they come across these roses?
82-year-old Carlene Taniguchi-Tinker is a survivor of Amachi, officially the Grenada Relocation Center. She was three when she and her parents were forced from their home in California. For the last decade or so, she's returned to Amachi to help unearth its history and her own with the help of archaeologist Bonnie Clark of the University of Denver.
Every time I've been at Amachi, I have gone to check on the roses, especially when we've had a lot of rain, because I thought, well, maybe. I mean, they are hardy, they are living, but I have never seen them bloom.
Clark's theory is that the incarcerated Amachians planted the roses. Many were gardeners, she says. And in hopes of learning more and finally seeing a bloom, Clark invited the Denver Botanic Gardens to take clippings. Horticulturist Mike Bone has been babying them ever since in a massive greenhouse.
We are standing in front of a bit of a mystery, aren't we?
It is. This is a rose that we've been working on that we're not sure what color it is, what the parents are.
The cuttings are thriving, and two were sent to Carlene Tent.
Propagated them, and gosh, they were showing survivorship just like we were.
The thought was that Taniguchi Tinker's clippings, or the ones at the Botanic Gardens, would blossom first by midsummer. But when Bonnie Clark visited Amachi recently, a surprise was in store.
God.
Along by the elements, produced a bud. This happened the same year Amachi became a National Historic Site, the same month Americans celebrate Asian heritage, and the same day as an annual pilgrimage to the camp. Again, archaeologist Bonnie Clark.
We literally drove from the cemetery at the end of the ceremony up the road to the Amachi roses. We looked down and somebody said, "Is that a bud?" And there is a little teeny tiny delicate pink bud on that Amachi rose. For the first time anyone in 80 years that we know of has seen it.
Carlene Taniguchi Tinker calls it a miracle.
These witness roses are saying, "Welcome home, pilgrims." So this year captures a whole bit of history.
And now she waits for the Amachi roses in her own backyard to bloom. For NPR News, I'm Ryan Warner in Denver.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Melissa Ingalls. Thanks for listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's on the air weekdays from 5 to 9.
Orab Area Arts Association. With the Spring Art Tour, June 3rd through 5th. Artist studios of painters, sculptors, and more. Along scenic byways of the Driftless region. SpringArtTour.com.
Support comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Whether you need information about Medicare, housing options, home care, or accessible transportation, the ADRC is the place to start. Their services are free. Call 262-605-6646.
You're listening to WGT.